Today, a very special original episode of the podcast. I'm talking to my longtime friend, historical novelist Mike Mizrahi, about his riveting new novel, The Weight of Loyalty. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Beached White Male podcast. So glad you found us. My name is Ken Kemp, and I am your host and here for season 6 and episode 38. I love historical novels. I've read a bunch of them. It all started when I discovered James Michener back in my 20s. I made a commitment to read all of his books. Well, I didn't read them all, but I think I read 6 or 7 or 8 of them. They're great books. And now I've got a longtime friend, a guy I've known since he was a high school kid and I was newly married, Mike Mizrahi. And he has written 6 historical novels. We're going to talk about his latest one today. It's a page-turner. I couldn't put it down. It's a story about war and the Greek Isles and food and romance and fighting for the things that really matter. You know, when I called my friend Mike and I said, Mike, let's do a podcast and talk about your book, we both got excited. I didn't realize that I'd caught him on a ferry. He lives up in the Pacific Northwest, and I think he had just left Port Townsend along with his wife, Karen, and he was on his way to Seattle. And when we started our conversation for the podcast today, he said, Ken, I've got to tell you a story, a crazy story.
So I'm on the ferry, and you and I are talking, and I'm all jazzed because, you know, Ken Kemp, my favorite writer, tells me that he really liked my book and, you know, wants to do a podcast, and I'm just jazzed. So I'm finishing up with you and I'm walking back. You've been on the ferries. It's a great way to travel. And so there's these long seats that you sit in. And so Karen and I, of course, grabbed a long seat, always lots of room. And so anyway, I'm kind of looking down, but finishing up talking with you, and I scoot up, you know, next to Karen, and I go, and I'm, you know, kind of disconnecting my phone, and I go, oh man, Kent said he really loved the book. And I look to my right, it's not Karen. It's this woman with a look on her face. I almost lost it. I went, oh, what? I'm so sorry. And I was shoulder to shoulder with her. She's looking at me, and I go, I'm so sorry. And Karen is in the seat right in front of this row. She's looking back at me. Oh my gosh. Anyway, what's great is that it often happens on the Washington ferries. It opened up a whole conversation.
It was not Karen, but it opened a great conversation. And no surprise, I think she's going to become a reader of the book, just like I hope you will. So that's why I'm glad you're here, to join us in a conversation about a great book, a great story, and a great friendship. So welcome to the podcast. That's right. Welcome to the podcast. So glad you chose to join us, especially if you're with us for the very first time. A special welcome to you, and I hope that as you listen, you feel a little bit like you're just not alone. You're one of us. We're just glad you joined us for this conversation today. And a big welcome to all of my regulars, especially those of you who support me as patrons and supporters on my Substack page. I'm so grateful to you. And if you've been thinking about it, and you like what we're doing here and you want to be part of it, just click on the link in the show notes and you'll find out exactly what it means to become one of my supporters, an insider here at the Beached White Male Podcast. I'd like that a lot. I wasn't exaggerating when I talked about how much I enjoyed Mike's newest novel, The Weight of Loyalty. I just couldn't put it down. And as I wrote in the show notes, it's a sweeping story of love, sacrifice, and moral conflict, set with a backdrop of World War II on the Greek island of Kefalonia. As I mentioned, Mike and I have a long history. We've known each other for many, many years, and we've stayed in touch. And I remember when he got his undergraduate degree in journalism, and then a master's degree in corporate communication, and then his career as a corporate spokesman for the big utility in Southern California, the gas company. But now in retirement, he has found his real passion, writing historical fiction. And his latest, The Weight of Loyalty, is just a great achievement. Mike's book is inspired by the real-life survival story of Royal Navy seaman John Capes, a British submariner who survived when his submarine was hit by a mine and it sunk to the bottom. Capes was the only survivor in the heat of World War II. Mike created a fictional account of Capes' story based on the historical character John Capes. The protagonist of the book is Oliver Graham. And the beautiful Greek woman that plays a key role in the novel is Natalia. I think you know that I love to talk to writers and readers. And in our conversation, we talk about historical fiction and why it matters, what drew Mike to this particular time and place, and how his personal research, a research tour right there on the island of Kefalonia, how it shaped every detail from the rugged landscape to the local cuisine to miracle-working monks. Now, it's not just a war story. It's a love story on many levels, and a deeply reflective one at that. Mike wrestles with the big questions, the cost of conscience, the meaning of faith, and what it really means to be loyal. Now, if you've ever wondered if fiction can serve as therapy, you're going to want to hear the last part of our conversation. So let's get to it. Here he is, novelist Mike Mizrahi. Hey, everybody. You know, it's about time that I invite my longtime historical novel writer, author, friend, Mike Mizrahi to the Beached White Male podcast. Welcome, Mike.
I am so excited. I can't believe that you're putting me on this podcast. Thank you, Kenny. Thank you.
Well, Mike, I think, gosh, you've written, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 books. I've read 4 of them. And I just finished your most recent book, which I'm going to start by congratulating you, Mike. I love this book. I've loved your other books, too, but this one just really got me. It's called The Weight of Loyalty. It's quite an achievement. Congratulations for getting it done and getting it out there. It's already getting great reviews.
Oh, thank you, Ken. Thank you. It really was a labor of love.
And it's gonna get a great review from me, too, because I think... you know, after people listen to this podcast, they're going to go, wow, Ken loved that book. I'm going to have to read it. And I hope that's what's happened. I hope that's exactly what happens here. But Mike, I want to start with kind of some personal stuff about our background because, you know, I think the first time we met, you were a high school kid and I was a newly married guy. I think I was 22. Which you must have thought I was an old guy back then, and here we are now, both retired, and we've maintained this close friendship all through these years. It's been rich.
It's been a blessing, is what it's been. So, and
I remember, Mike, when you found Karen, and I remember when you went off to Boston. I think you did an MA in journalism, wasn't it? Isn't that what you got?
I got an undergraduate in journalism and a master's in corporate public relations.
That was it. And then you had a career with the gas company. And I remember seeing you on TV once in a while because you became the spokesperson for the gas company. Whenever there was a crisis somewhere in Southern California, you know, that you were the go-to guy to give the corporate spin, which you did quite well.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Ken. Thank you. Yeah. Interesting to try and do that when you talk about the weight of loyalty, when you have to be loyal to who you represent. And maybe sometimes that's a little touch and go.
Well, it's important, I think, you know, to keep people from panicking, you know, and all that. But that was your skill. And you wrote for the company. You've always loved writing. But now, as a retired guy, you focused on historical fiction, which I love. I got to tell you that I remember I discovered James Michener, I think, in my 20s. And in fact, I ran into a friend. We both made a challenge. We're going to read every
historical fiction that James Michener, every fiction book that Michener wrote, and I don't know, I think I got through five or six or seven of them, and pretty soon I figured out they were kind of gotten formulaic, but it was the way I loved to study history, because it gives us the human dimension. That's what I loved about it, the characters and the impact of historical events on real people. Is that kind of what draws you to historic fiction, or tell us about it?
Well, I just love history in general. I'm particularly love American history, although this novel is not American history. Involves a British sailor on a submarine. But I love the confluence of researching history and then applying my ability to tell a story. And early on, I leaned a little bit too much on telling the history, and I needed to learn how to bring the two together properly and actually tell a story within the history. That's something that I love to do, but researching is a kick.
We're going to have a link to all of your books, so people can see the breadth of what you've done. And I read Cabarisi's Revenge, which is a story about Africa. I read about the Great Chattanooga Bicycle Race, which was awesome. It was turn of the century stuff in America. I read The Unnamed Girl, which was a Civil War book, and now The Weight of Loyalty. And you know what? I love this little quote about the book. I think this kind of sets the stage for us. In a story that intertwines love and sacrifice against the backdrop of war, The Weight of Loyalty explores the resilience of the human spirit and the lengths one will go for love. That pretty well nails it. I got to give a little spoiler alert here, because if you're listening today, we want to welcome you, but also if you're the type of person who just doesn't want to know anything about a book until you've read it, you might want to hit pause right now. This is a spoiler alert, because we're going to get into the particulars of the book. We won't give away the ending, but we're going to get into the particulars, and go read the book and come back and listen to the rest of our conversation, because we're going to unpack it today. Does that sound okay, Mike?
That sounds perfect. Love it.
All right, let's start with the discovery of the story of John Capes. Tell us just how you found the story, and then just give us a little synopsis of the actual event that surrounds this character, this Royal Navy seaman, John Capes.
Yeah, that's a great tee up, Ken. Thank you. So in my writing, and I'm trying to figure out, what do I want to write about next? Oftentimes what I'll do is I'll go to the World Wide Web, the internet, call it what you will. And now you can actually even go to ChatGPT and use it as a research tool, which is very
helpful. I do often. I use it often. I love it.
Yeah. So I'll go online just kind of trolling, trying to figure out what's going on here. I might plug some, word searches in. And I've been really fortunate with this book and with my past books to actually stumble upon something that catches my interest. And I go, well, okay, that's different. And that sends me, in a certain direction. And, in some cases, it works out. I can envision a story around what I've discovered. And in other cases, it doesn't. So
I think you've told me, Mike, that that you're looking for a story that it just is intriguing. Maybe there are a lot of question marks around it. And maybe it's one that just really hasn't been that fully explored, by other novelists or other. There's enough information to give you an idea of what's going on, but there's still a lot of unanswered questions around the story. Am I getting that right?
You're absolutely getting it right, because that's my next step. If I discover something, and the idea isn't necessarily there in front of me, but my mind, my imagination starts to turn, And I think, ooh, that would be interesting to go down this road with this historical event. The next step that I have is to say, has anybody done this?
Yes.
Has this been written about? So in this book, when I found the story, the real story, I immediately went online and said, hey, you know, anybody talked about John Capes? Have there been any books? I'll go to Amazon. No books. And I'm going, yes.
You found it. All right. Well, tell us about John Capes, the Submariner, and the island of Kefalonia. Just give us a little synopsis of what happened to him in history that got your attention.
Well, John Capes, like you just mentioned, is he's a lead stoker on a British submarine that is in 1940-41 trolling the islands around Greece into the Mediterranean, looking for ways to subvert, you know, the Nazis.
And it's a world at war.
It's a world at war. And, you know, the Nazis are allied with Italy, Mussolini's Italy. Mm-hmm. And so Capes is in Malta, where the sub is had a stop. It's in port.
Island of in the Mediterranean.
That's right. And he has an accident on Malta. He smashes a guy's cart with fruits and vegetables and all of that.
Oh, so that's history. That's in the book.
Yes.
Okay. So that is actually historical.
So he's got an accident and he's about to you know, the sub is going to leave for Alexandria. No, the sub is going to leave for Alexandria. And he can't go yet.
From Kefalonia?
No, he's not in Kefalonia. He's still in Malta.
Oh, he's in Malta.
Yeah. So his sub has to leave, and he has to get on another sub as a hitchhiker. But he's got to come back. He's got to come back to Malta to settle up with this this accident and make good. So he eventually hitchhikes a ride to get back to his sub in Alexandria, and the sub in off the coast of Greece hits a mine, and it goes down to the bottom of the Ionian Sea. The Ionian Sea has, I believe it's seven islands, the biggest of which is Kefalonia, and the sub goes down, and lo and behold, this guy is able to escape through an escape hatch. The only survivor. He helps two or three other guys.
He tries to help some other guys, but didn't.
Yeah. But it didn't work out. And he comes to the surface, looks off to the east, and he sees these white cliffs and these mountains, and he starts swimming and swimming and swimming, and eventually reaches the shore, passes out. He's rescued by a couple of villagers, and they proceed to hide him for 18 months. All of this is true.
Right. These are the facts of the story, at least as you've been able to determine them.
That's right. And so they hide him for 18 months until finally in 1943, just before, 2 months before a horrible event on Kefalonia, he's able to get a ride off the island and makes his way back to the war effort. Mm-hmm. That horrible event was a massacre that took place two months later.
Yes.
So that's the story of John Capes. Nobody believes him. He gets back into the war and he spends the rest of the time trying to, you know, tell his story. So when I'm trolling through the internet, I see the story retold by the BBC in 2011 on an article. And I'm going, holy smokes, nobody has written about this? What happened during those 18 months? I know what happened. I know how he got there. I kind of know how he got off. But I can't find anything about his life for 18 months, other than the villagers are moving him from house to house.
So
this is the kind of the kernel, the seed of the story that you develop. And you know what? Even before we get into the particulars, I want to know where you got the title, "The Weight of Loyalty." And that comes up several times in the book. You know, people refer to that, but where did that title come from in your mind?
Well, the actual working title until almost the end was The Dubious Tale of Oliver Graham.
Ah, okay.
That's what I was...
That's what you were working with.
That's what I was working with.
This is not uncommon, by the way, for you to have a working title. But when you get done with the book, you go, got another idea.
And
tell us about that.
Well, the other idea is by the time the story is over, Oliver Graham falls in love with Natalia. And now his loyalty in the beginning was to get off the island and return to the war effort. Mm. Love has a way of complicating things. And so the weight of his loyalty to the Navy effort now becomes very... switched over to the weight of loyalty he has to Natalia out of love. He ends up at the end of the story trying to decide, can I leave the island?
Which is it? Exactly. Yeah. Oh, okay. That is so good. I got about halfway through the book, Mike, when I found myself just putting it down and I'm going, oh my gosh, Mike has written a love story. This is a love story. And it's not just a love story between these two characters, Natalia being, you know, one of the Greek residents of the island who basically nurse him back to health. But it's a love story of the island. It's a love story of the life that Natalia lived on the island. And Oliver is struck not only by her beauty, but her whole personhood, her whole, you know, everything about her, including her family and the land she lives in and her community and her relatives. And I'm also going to say here, her religion, we're going to get into that a little bit. You and Karen decide to go to Kefalonia to do your own homework. Yeah. And when you got there, I think you fell in love with that island, Mike, the landscape, the family, the vineyards, the wildlife, the sights. Tell us what prompted you to go and what did you find when you got there?
That's a great question. A lot wrapped up in that. I'll try to truncate it. First of all, I'm half Greek. So
boom.
The idea of setting the story in Greece, came pretty quick. And growing up, I up until my grandparents passed away, I was in
on the Greek side.
I was in the environment. Actually, it was at Redondo.
Now, this is your mother's family, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
In Redondo Beach, California, every Sunday, my family would go to a kind of a park area at Redondo Beach, where all of the old people would gather,
wow.
You know, the immigrants who came right. over. And I have a memory of the smells of the Greek food being cooked on the grills. I have a memory of, you know, several circles in this little park area where men, two, three, four men were playing, you know, baglamas,
yes.
You know, tamburas, you know, the different Greek. And so you would hear the Greek music ringing out. Mm-hmm. I have memories of people dancing there. And so going to, you know, write about Kefalonia and going to Kefalonia, all of that was floating through my memory of my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Going to Kefalonia, though, was the idea behind that was as an author, I can do research from here in my office, but I need to touch, I need to feel, I need to hear, I need to see. I can write about certain elements, but there are certain things I need to see. I wanted to see the villages
yes.
That I was writing about. I wanted to meet the people that I was writing about. So we went to Kefalonia, and we were there for 3 days. And there's an amazing story. Can I tell you this story?
Yes, please do.
Okay, so I wanted to talk to some people. I actually went to a historical society on Kefalonia in Argostoli, which is the major city of Kefalonia. And again, Kefalonia is the largest of the Ionian Islands. And it's just off the coast of Greece, the west coast of Greece. So I go to this society, and it's a small little kind of hole in the wall. And I talk to this woman who's actually from New York. And I tell her what I'm doing. And she says, well, I don't have anything here. All of the people are very aware of the story. I mean, everybody on Kefalonia knows the story of John Capes.
Interesting.
And she said, but she said, all of the people that were involved in that story with Capes are all dead. With the exception of one. One man.
Wow.
And where can I find this one man? Because I need to do an interview. I need to, you know, I need to talk to him. And she says, oh, he's across the square. Just go down over left, right, you know, two blocks, three blocks. You'll find his little space that he has set up. So I go there and there's two young women and I go through the same, kind of the same story with them. And I go, is there a way that I can talk to Spiros?
And these are all English speakers, by the way.
Oh, yeah, they're all
English. Okay, this helps. This helps.
Is there a way I can talk to Spiros Kosmetaros? Because his mother was a principal player. I talk about her in the book, in hiding Capes. And he was...
This would be Helen in the book.
Yes. And he was 4 years old. Four, five, 6 years old for the year and a half. So so Capes would have known him. So anyway, I go and I say, can I see him? She go, well, he's old. He's 85. He doesn't come down here. Can I write out some questions? Maybe you can give it to him and see if I can get answers through the mail. Sure. So I leave and I'm a little bit disappointed. And so Karen, God bless her, gets on the internet and finds a winery for us to go to.
Wow.
And I wanted to go to a different winery. Every winery is closed except for one. They're still barely open. She calls and, oh yeah, come on in. We'll do a wine tasting. So we approach this winery. We get there and a guy comes out and greets us. Hi, why are you on Kefalonia? I tell him, and he goes, well, you know, this winery is owned by Spiros Kosmetaros.
Oh, my gosh. And you did not know that
until you got there.
Wow. Wow.
And this is just like out of the dark. We end up right in the lap. And I go, is there any way that I – is he here? Where is he? Oh, he lives up the hill of the winery. He goes, would you like to meet him? Oh, my goodness. Would I like to meet him?
Yes.
He makes a call. Spiros comes down, and I sit across from him on a bench while we're doing the wine tasting for about an hour, peppering him with questions, writing down his answers. And then he pulls out a book. His son-in-law pulls. It's Spiros' daughter is married to this guy that that I first met. And he pulls out this book that they had done on the history of Kefalonia.
Oh my gosh!
From 1900 to like early 1960s.
Wow!
I have everything that I've asked him about, and it's in the book.
It's in the book.
Was there electricity? You know, what were the roads like? What was the occupation like? Right. Was there an underground resistance?
Right.
All of this starts to get pulled together by this happenstance, by this amazing confluence of events.
Wow.
And that,
were you able to get your hands on that book? Or
yes.
So was there another copy of it, or did they actually loan you that copy? How did that work?
I think they had several copies of
it. Okay, so they gave you a copy of the book. Now you're able to take it and read the whole thing.
I tore through it.
I'll bet you did.
I made notes.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just, it was, you know, I'm going to say it was a God thing for me.
Anyway, indeed, indeed.
You know, it's like what I needed, what I came for.
Boom. And
otherwise, I'm here in America trying to write this book, wondering how am I going to pull all these pieces together that I'm missing.
Right. And you create this story, Mike. I think it would be good to just kind of give us an overview of what was happening on Kefalonia during World War II. You know, and it has to do with the initial occupation by Mussolini's fascists, the Italians. But then as you tell the story, you know, when Italy surrendered, now all of a sudden the Italians are targets of Hitler's Nazis. And then there's a wave of Germans coming through. And this is what the Kefalonian residents were dealing with, the occupation first of the Italians. And am I getting that right? Can you give us just a little overview of the history of the island during the war?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So war starts. Hitler joins forces to create the Axis powers, Mussolini being one of them. And as Hitler kind of expands his horizons to the south, he ends up eventually invading Germany and occupying
Italy.
Italy.
Yeah.
Greece, and then Greece. So he goes to Greece and he occupies Greece. And of course, Mussolini needs to get in on this play. And so Hitler gives Mussolini the Ionian Islands, among other things. So Mussolini is going to end up with those islands, which he has every intention to annex and to make a part of Italy. And so we have this double occupation, and that's where we are in the beginning of the story of John Capes. His main dilemma is how to avoid the Italians.
Being even recognized. He's a British officer, and he's the enemy of the Italians.
That's right. And what he ends up doing eventually is he ends up because he's working outside somewhat, he ends up getting darker complected. He dyes his hair black so that he can blend in more. But for the most part, in the real story, he's hiding.
He's in hiding.
In the houses, yeah.
He knows if he becomes a prisoner of war, it's probably going to be over for him.
Oh yeah, he's going to face a firing squad or be hung or.
And so yeah. I wanted to ask you, Mike, when you were on Kefalonia, did you get around and see some of these sites? Because you talk about some of the places where, and for us, it's Oliver in the novel, where Oliver finds hiding. There are a couple of monasteries. I think there's the Assumption of Mary and the story of the snakes around that thing.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Did you visit some of those places? You had a limited amount of time while you were there.
Yeah, we did. I focused, honestly, Ken, I focused more on Argostoli, which is the major
city. That's the big city.
That's the big city, and that's where you find most of the Italians. And then I focus on Mount Aenos.
Yes.
Which is the largest peak on Kefalonia. Hmm. And we did.
You got
there. Took the car all up Mount Aenos. A lot happens there. That's where the underground resistance really started to take shape. And it's where Oliver and Natalia end up through a course of events. They have to flee, and they end up going up to Mount Aenos and joining the underground resistance. So that was a major place. And then Catalios Beach. Mm. Catalios Beach is where Oliver kind of washes onto shore.
Yes.
I wanted.
Was that the actual place, or was that unknown?
No, that was the place.
So you knew when you were standing on that beach that this is where he landed when he took that swim.
Yeah, and so I don't know if you can picture, but you know, here's Oliver swimming toward these white hills
in almost like the hills of Dover, the cliffs of Dover.
Right?
Is that almost what it's like? They're like chalk white.
Yeah. So he ends up on the beach, and he's saved by, in my story, saved by Natalia, not by two other villagers.
Right.
And he ends up in a cave on the beach. She pulls him in there until she can arrange for him to be brought up to Mavrata.
Right.
Mavrata is another place I absolutely needed to visit. And to, you know.
And this was her home, right?
This is her village.
Yes.
A lot of the action, or some of the action of the book, takes place in Mavrata. Mm-hmm. It's her hometown. It's her place. Natalia is unlike Oliver. Oliver's a loner and somewhat of an alcoholic and a womanizer.
Right.
Natalia.
I'm not giving anything away. That's the, that's chapter one.
That's right.
That's the first chapter.
That's right.
All right, Mike, I got to ask you one more thing about the island. And I don't know that you got here, but I checked out this Melisani Cave Lake.
Yes.
And it is extraordinary. It's a geological wonder. And you do create a scene there. And I don't know that you just know about it, or did you actually get to see it?
I saw it.
You saw it. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
This lake, it's almost like under a dome that has an opening. I mean, is that what it looks like? It's this cave?
It's
huge.
Yeah. It's pretty big. And you know, Karen and I, you know, walked down many steps, you know, to get
to the water,
to where the water is. And indeed it's, I can't remember exactly why there's an opening.
It almost looks like an old sinkhole. I saw something like that actually in Thailand. That it mm-hmm. reminded me. And it almost looks like, you know, way back when there was this big sinkhole under this mountain that just kind of opened things up. And then it got filled with water. And it's mm-hmm. a place that you can actually, I guess, rent a boat. And the water is crystal clear. And the light comes through, you know, from up top. It's extraordinary.
This place plays a role in the story, because kind of the sub story has to do with this Italian colonel who is fixated on Natalia.
Yes.
She's gorgeous. She's a beautiful Greek woman, and he wants to court her. And he, through threats, actually, she has to, you know, go with him on a couple of different outings, and they end up at this place. And so I absolutely needed to see this. It's the walls are covered, the rock walls, or what are they called? Stalagmites or?
Yes,
stalagmites,
yes.
Or, you know, it's just different crystal looking, colorful. It's quite cool to see.
Yeah, it's an amazing place. And that was a larger question I wanted to throw at you, Mike, because. What I noticed in this book is how much time you spend, and forgive my phrase, I could probably find a better way to say this, but in the heads of your character. I mean, we're hearing what they're thinking. We hear how they respond, you know, to different characters and different situations and decisions they need to make. Particularly into Oliver's head, and the story is in first person, both with Oliver and also with Natalia. And just as a storytelling technique, just talk about how you've come to this. And I think it's one of the things that makes you a great storyteller, because you're putting us in the minds of these characters.
Oh, thank you, Ken. That's quite a compliment. Again, I'm going to say, coming from my favorite writer, that just means a lot to me. Early on in my writing, I would often go to third person past tense.
Mm.
Here, in my point of views, I have two POV characters, point of view characters, the two main principals, Natalia and Oliver. And by going to first person present tense,
right,
it allows the reader to actually get more personally involved in what the character is doing and in particular what the character is thinking. Mm-hmm. Of course, when I have a scene and Oliver is in the first person present tense, I have to be very careful that Natalia can't tell what's in his mind.
Right. Okay?
She has to learn through Oliver's actions what's going on, and vice versa when we're in Natalia's mind. But the reader gets a more intimate involvement with the character.
Yeah, this happens a couple of times, maybe several times in the book, where something will happen, and then we'll see what Oliver's thinking about that event, and then we'll also get the sense of what Natalie is thinking about the same event, and they're two different people, so they're interpreting it in different ways, but they're also looking at the other and trying to figure out what they're thinking, like Oliver is trying to figure out, well, what's Natalie thinking? And Natalia is going, what is Oliver thinking? And it makes her just a fascinating human drama, because that's the way we live. You know, we frequently find ourselves in a place where we're watching something. Now, I wonder what they really think about what was just said or what's happening. You know, that's life.
And what the reader gets is the ability to kind of, you know, jump into both of their minds, mm-hmm. as you're reading, you know, what is Natalia thinking? What is Oliver thinking? And I think I'll probably continue to write in that POV, because it really gives you a lot. It gives me a lot of accessibility to the characters. So I did, you mentioned it earlier, I did spend a lot more time in the character development stage in this book.
All right. One more subject, you know, that I do want to get into a little bit. And that's theology. I want to talk a little bit about theology because, you know, I know where you're coming from. You and I have so much in common. You're a committed Christian. You know, I was kind of wondering, you know, how that would play into your storytelling. And I just found it so interesting, Mike, that it was a light touch for you, but you get into Oliver's head, who was raised by kind of a hardcore agnostic, you know, reason oriented father, you know, pragmatic father who had very little time for religion. And that kind of spilled over in Oliver. He's got the same kind of skepticism, but he encounters this. Well, first of all, he encounters what you and I would have to call miracles, because I don't know how real this thing is from history, but when he comes out of the hatch of the submarine and surprises himself by coming to the surface and actually able to breathe and swim, first thing he encounters is a shark. But then the next thing he encounters is a dolphin who plays with him and literally kind of takes him home. And those dolphins kind of play a role in the whole story that just kind of remind us that there's something bigger going on that we'll never quite be able to understand. How did that work? Was that a miracle? Is there a God who, brought this dolphin into the water here and saved my life? But then Natalia, and it's interesting to just hear again about your Greek heritage. And then, you know, I think Karen also has kind of an Orthodox background from her childhood too, Eastern Orthodox kind of church religion kind of thing. But what I see here is your appreciation for Natalia's relationship to God. She prays, you know, that's an important part of her, so important to where she says, you know, Oliver, if you want us to do something permanent here, you know, I need to have a man who loves God. I think that was it. That was in the book. Mm-hmm. Just talk about how, in a very light sense, because I think, you know, this is not a classic evangelical book where, you know, these guys come to Jesus and live happily ever after at the end of the book. That's not the way it works. But you still wrap in these larger questions about God and about what role faith plays in survival and in family, you know, and all that. Did that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's, yeah. So one of the things that I really enjoy about historical fiction is it allows me to go back to a time when faith was perhaps more of an integral part in the life of people, mm-hmm. Than it is today. Mm-hmm. And like you said, I do have, you know, a specific Christian worldview. But as a writer, I don't want to foist that on people. Mm-hmm. But I do want to explore the spiritual side of people. And it's easy for me to do that. You mentioned a book that goes back to the Civil War. Very easy for me to weave in the, you know, faith perspectives of my characters. In this case, in this book,
that's the unnamed girl. That's,
yes.
Yeah.
In this case, you know, the same thing. And it's that faith perspective that actually ends up changing Oliver from the man who landed on that beach and fell in love with Natalia and saw and Natalia being, I don't know, she's mad at fascism. She's
mad at the invasion and the disruption of her life and culture and what it's doing to families and businesses.
Her own community. Family. She loses a fiance and one brother to
the war.
This war. And so what Oliver brings to Natalia eventually is a subduing of that passion. Love works on Natalia, and Natalia's love for Oliver and for her God works on Oliver.
Yes.
And so the two of them have a character arc through this book that I think is satisfying.
He has kind of a crisis of conscience. You know. First of all, what he sees, you know, when you described in your own childhood in the park, where was it, in Torrance somewhere on the
West, Redondo Beach?
In Redondo Beach, you know, you described those scenes, and a lot of it happens at the vineyard. You know, with Helen and. And what was his name? Lucas.
Yeah,
this
Lucas.
Is Oliver. Yeah, but when he visits the vineyard and he sees the life and the marriages and the family and the, you know, and the parties and the food and by the way, you get into the food. There's a lot of food in there. But he has this crisis of conscience. You know, trying to put together what he grew up with what he's seeing with his own eyes on the island of Kefalonia when it comes to God and faith. But he also has this crisis of conscience over, am I going to be able to kill?
Yes.
I mean, I know I'm in war, and I know if I don't kill him, he's going to kill me. Can I pull the trigger? You know, that was something that came up a couple of times in the book.
Yes. So Oliver, of course, is under the water. And he wants to serve his country, and that's the safest place he can see to serve it. It's not that he's a coward. He's just got this, like you said, crisis of conscience. And it's one thing to be a part of a machine that sends a torpedo and blows up another ship.
Right.
It's another thing to go eyeball to eyeball with a fellow soldier and be responsible for ending that person's life. Mm. So this is very much a crisis, and he faces this crisis head on toward the end of the book. I won't say exactly how. I'll leave.
No, we're not going to give away the ending here. I'm tempted to do it. I'm going to say this, Mike. The ending did take me by surprise. That's all I'm going to say, which is a good thing. But I'm not going to say what it is. Except to encourage people to hang in there, read the whole book, take it all the way to the end. But right. And when we're talking about the complexity of these characters, I think about Battaglia, you know, the Italian officer who, who really tries to bring Natalia and Natalia into his life. And we kind of suspect what his motives are, that he wants like a concubine, a Greek, that's really what everybody assumes that he's after. And yet you even humanize that guy.
Okay? Yeah.
Ultimately we realize that he's a family guy too. And in fact, Nazism has disrupted his world. He was also, I think he was a vintner. He had a vineyard.
Yeah.
I think if I remember right. But you give us the complexity of these characters. He's a villain on many levels, and yet he's a human being as well. And when we go back to Oliver pulling the trigger, looking eyeball to eyeball, he realizes that's a human being over there. And
that's another application, I think, what you're describing about the weight of loyalty. It's why that title just kept ringing in my mind.
Yes.
What is the weight of loyalty for Battaglia, who is the antagonist, really, in this book? But he's a human who has been brought into this war, not because he wanted to go, but because, he was loyal and he was had to go. What's the weight of loyalty that Battaglia has to his wife? Mm-hmm. When he's
and his kids, he had children.
And when he's at war on an island for month after month, year after year, and lonely, what's the weight of loyalty to him? Will it change him? What does it do to us when we have those kinds of decisions? How does it change us?
Well, listener, if you're not interested in reading the book at this point, you haven't been paying attention because there's so much in this novel, Mike. I got one more question I want to ask before we wrap up. And you and I know each other pretty well.
Oh my gosh.
We've got years of history. We've got common friends. We've gone through the decades, through the politics and all this stuff that's gone on, our marriages, our kids, our families. We've been through all that. And, as I say that, Mike, as I read the book, I couldn't help but see autobiographical elements in the story, characters that reflect some of the people that we've known, where we grew up, our parents, all those things are kind of in there. I just want to ask the question this way. How is writing historical fiction, a kind of therapy, a kind of personal therapy, a way to kind of work out all of our stuff? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. As I evaluate that question, I have to say it's purposeful. Mm-hmm. I will write things purposefully into my books, but then to a certain degree, it's subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't really thought all that much about my early life and how being around the old people from the old country and all of the sights and sounds and tastes that are still clear in my memory, I hadn't really quite thought about how I actually transferred that into the book. I mean, I wrote it, but I wasn't specifically necessarily thinking about the past. But it's very much about my childhood. And then there are other areas, sometimes hard things that I have faced. Oliver has a father issue, and I had a father issue. And oh, by the way, that young Ken Kemp, who mentored me when I was 17 years old, you were only 3 years older, 4 years older, but you were like a father figure. To me.
Wow.
So, Yeah, those things definitely make their way into my writing, and it's comforting. It's soothing.
Well, I love to talk to writers. It's not uncommon for me to talk to fellow writers, and a lot of my friends write. But I got to say, Mike, you're right up there. You are one of the very best, and this book is Exhibit A. And there's also Exhibit B, C, D, and E out there. And so we're going to have a link to in our show notes to where you can find all of this work, but especially the book that we're talking about, The Weight of Loyalty by Mike Mizrahi. Mike, just tell us a little bit more about how people can find you as we wrap up.
Well, you can go to my website, which is MikeHMizrahi.com. And there's quite a bit of stuff about my writing. I write Substack. I've got several books. I've written several blogs. You can read more there. Of course, if you want to go to Amazon.com, when you get there, you can either write in Mike H. Mizrahi. Do it that way because there's another Mike Mizrahi.
Yes, there is.
Mike H. I had to put that H in there.
There you go.
H. Mizrahi, or you can just plug in The Weight of Loyalty, and it'll take you to the books. And
we'll have links in the show notes. You want to get there. We're also going to have a couple of videos that can kind of illustrate the story and will be even more motivation for you to get your hands on that book and read it like I did.
Hey, Ken, can I make a request?
Yes.
Real quick. If you do read the book, thank you. And if you will, go back to Amazon and leave a review. It's
like
gold. If you didn't like it, still leave a review. If you like
it.
Either way.
But I doubt there'll be many of those, Mike. But well said. And we want to encourage everybody to do that. Mike, this isn't the last time we're going to do this. I've been looking forward to this ever since I started the book, actually. And then finally, when I finished it, I said, we've got to do this. Thanks so much for taking time out of your writing schedule to join us and unpack and talk about the book. And we'll look forward to more.
Thank you so much, Ken. Anytime I can speak or see you is just a blessing to me. Thank you, brother.
Here, here. This has been good. All right, take care, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Best regards and hugs to Karen.
And to Carolyn.
Yep. Bye-bye. Alrighty then, that's a wrap for Season 6 and Episode 38 of the Beached White Male Podcast. We're calling this one Exploring the Weight of Loyalty with author Mike Mizrahi. Wow, I just really enjoyed that one. I hope you get a sense of how rich it is to have real friendship alive and well for this many years. And to watch my friend Mike become just a master storyteller, a prolific writer. And I want you to go to those show notes and click on the link where you can get your hands on the book. You'll also have the opportunity to see Mike's work, all of his books, and I know he would love to hear from you. Well, there's lots more coming on the podcast. I just scored a conversation with Dr. Randall Balmer. Again, we're going to be interviewing him soon. We're going to talk about the 100-year anniversary of the Scopes Trial of 1925, also known as the Scopes Monkey Trial. That's going to be a good one. I've got a couple more in the pipeline, too, so you're going to want to watch for those alerts. If you're a first-timer and you're still here, so glad you are, check out our website, thebeachedwhitemail.com, and you can learn all about us, and you'll get a chance to see all the amazing people that I've been able to interview through the years. I want to say thank you to Ben Sound for our soundtrack today and let you know how much I'm looking forward to seeing you next time. So until then, this is Ken Kemp, the Beached White Male, saying be strong. Keep healthy and stay curious. Bye-bye.